Amy Louise with you on BBC Radio Wales. So all the hits and headlines from another golden year starting at 11 o'clock this morning. First, horses' heads, Sean Corn and hunting wrens. Just a few of the traditional celebrations of Christmas and New Year of Christmas past. We'd love to hear about your Christmas traditions. 03700 100 110. Jamie Louise at bbc.co.uk. Dimitra Fumi is a lecturer in English at Cardiff Metropolitan University. And she's here to talk about Christmas folklore, traditions and how Christmas has been represented over the years in literature. Dimitra, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
A lot of these traditions come from the Victorian age, don't they? The things that we think are ye old Christmas past. I mean, they're relatively newish.
It's very true. We like to think that they come from a long, long time ago, you know, back to pagan times, etc. But most of those traditions are a couple of hundred years old, really. But in a way, you know, that's part of their charm because they reflect how society works and how social groups interact. And they bring people together. And different communities have different needs. And that's how these customs seem to have developed. So you talked about Sean Corn and the wren hunting and the Clennig and the Mary Lwyd. And a lot of those we see as very Welsh customs. But, for example, I'm not going to debunk everything, but with the Mary Lwyd, for example, this is, you know, you have the horse's head. And this really goes back to medieval mumming, this sense of going from house to house at this time of the year. And in a way, it's a glorified begging custom. It's this sense of sharing wealth and goods within the community and allowing people to do that without loss of face, really, and without loss of, you know, making sure that people don't feel bad about this.
Oh, that was where the horse's head came in, was it?
Well, the horse's head is... it's about making the noise and about scaring people as well and about having this agon, this... interaction between the people that are inside the house and the people that are outside. And there's a lot of merrymaking and good cheer there and kind of letting your hair down a bit and allowing the community sometimes to slightly misbehave as well. That's all right too.
Because we Welsh would like to think that this is part of an ancient Celtic horse sacrifice.
Yes.
I mean, the reality is a little different, isn't
it? Yes, yes.
It is newer, much newer.
It is. And also it is attested in other places in Britain as well. It's definitely attested in the north of England, in Kent. You know, it's not particularly only a Welsh custom. And it seems actually that our first evidence seems to come from the 19th century when you have the coal mining communities. So again, it seems to be associated with a particular social historical context. The pagan custom kind of link, it's all very romantic and charming. There's no evidence whatsoever. I mean, it's lovely to believe in it, but...
Tell us about the wren hunting. I hadn't heard of that before.
Yeah, again, this is all over Britain and Ireland as well. And this seems to be happening at St. Stephen's Day. The wren is always seen as a sacred bird. It's the smallest, I think, it's the smallest bird in the British Isles.
So we are talking about a feathered friend here,
not a member of
the armed services or anything
we
like
do.
That. Right,
No. This is a real, well, at the beginning at least, that was a real wren that, apparently, you know, you're not supposed to hunt birds like that, like robins or wrens, and they're always associated with, you know, kind of goodness and even, you know, being seen as sacred. But somehow on St. Stephen's Day, on Boxing Day, you can break the rules, and there was this belief as well that the gaming rules could be broken. So you'd again, this becomes a bit of a begging custom as well. So you'd have young boys or young men hunting wrens and then displaying them on a bier and taking them around the village and asking for money and singing carols. Obviously, nowadays we don't tend to kill the wren, so you have a presentation of it. In Ireland, at some point when, you know, where the killing of the wren became a bit of a problem, you'd have a live wren displayed on a glass box, for example. But it seems again to have to do with this idea of breaking the rules and of begging and of sharing goods.
How would you catch a wren?
I'm thinking,
do they use a net or would you have to, because if you were shooting, you'd have to be a pretty good shot because they're tiny.
Well, there wouldn't be much left either if you were shooting.
Well, exactly. They're tiny, aren't they?
Not that I'm really trying to suggest we shoot in any way whatsoever, just to be absolutely clear. What about Sean Corn? This is 19th century. I mean, it means chimney jack, doesn't it? I mean, this is associated with... the Welsh language movement in the 1930s, really?
Yes, I think so. I mean, this is one of those customs that, again, we want to believe that, you know, it is Sean Corn the Welsh answer to Santa Claus or Father Christmas. It's very recent, and to me, this is more connected with this kind of pursuit for a Welsh identity and creating a separate thing that stands as a Welsh symbol. So, Yeah, it is one of those invented traditions, I think.
And it's interesting, isn't it, because the period you're talking about and these Victorian traditions are a period of enormous social change in Britain, where we're actually not quite certain of where we're going, massive industrialisation.
That's the main thing, that the move from the countryside to the city, and a lot of these customs have to do with bringing a bit of the country in the home, you know, the Christmas tree, the holly, kind of, reclaiming this relationship with the nature and the countryside that had been lost with industrialization. And also, again, this sense of how do you create communities in this kind of...
this new world.
Yeah, in this totally new context. And that's where really Dickens does the most, you know, the most successful thing ever, because for Dickens, the way to actually solve the problems of industrialization is to use the novel as a social institution. That's why he's got all of these novels with orphan children, you know, young people that are struggling against, you know, hard times, this sense of revealing to the readership, especially the middle class readership, hardships and how society can be unfair at times. And this is where Christmas Carol is coming in. And goodness, he was a clever man, wasn't he? I mean, he created the winning formula for a Christmas story. And Christmas Carol is not the first one either. He had a short story in the Pickwick Papers, which was an earlier work. And the story is called The Story of the Goblins Who Stole a Sexton. And our character there is a sexton called Gabriel Grubb, very Dickensian name, who's an ill-conditioned, gross-grained, surly fellow, a morose and lonely man who consorted with nobody but himself. So he hates Christmas, he hates children. He decides to spend Christmas Eve by digging a grave for the next funeral in the church, that kind of guy. And he's confronted by the Goblin King and the goblins who, the supernatural element here as well, like with Christmas Carol, who take him away to a cave and actually show him visions of family love and charity and goodwill, and in between give him a few kicks and beatings. You know, it's very, a very physical kind of story, that one. And by Christmas morning, Gabriel Grubb is a changed man, and, you know, he's ready to see, you know, the goodness of Christmas and to celebrate it. So he's the original Ebenezer Scrooge, in a way.
I was going to say, there are such similarities, aren't there?
Absolutely. Yes. It's the same story, kind of retold from a different perspective.
And what about, let's look at a little bit at Welsh literature as well.
Yes,
of course,
yes.
We've got to mention Dylan Thomas, classic, Charles Christmas in Wales.
Absolutely beautiful piece. I mean, again, that was, interestingly, that was actually prepared for the radio. This was prepared for the BBC. And to me, one of the most charming things about this work is you can hear the lilt of the Welsh accent coming through the way it's written. You know, Dylan Thomas was a master of using language. And there are minutely remembrances of things like the weather and village activities and the sights and the sounds of Christmas as well. Mm. So a lot of visual imagery and oral, opening gifts. And, you know, he's got these beautiful paragraphs on them. The useful gifts and the useless gifts, you know, the scarves and the socks and then the mechanical engineering toys and the sweets. And also, you know, one of the lovely quotations, there are always uncles at Christmas, you know, this sense of the extended family coming together. And also, to me, you know, this is a lovely memory of Christmas because he's meshing together loads of different Christmases from his childhood. At the beginning, he says, one Christmas was so much like another in those years around the sea town corner now that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12 or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was six. And you get this sense of him kind of putting all these memories together and creating an amalgamation of his Christmases.
Mm. And these new traditions very quickly become part of the furniture, don't they? Mm. You think of something like Tennyson writing In Memoriam, a poem showing how someone deals with the death of a loved one and their feelings, struggling at Christmas when they're alone. That was that quickly became popular because of Queen Victoria's adopting of Tennyson.
She was very much moved by this poem, especially after the death of Prince Albert in 1861. And this is obviously a famous love story between the two of them. And he died very close to Christmas. His funeral was on the 23rd of December. 1861. And Albert in Victorian culture is associated with Christmas celebrations because he brought the Christmas tree in the royal household. You know, there's this famous illustration in the Illustrated London News where the whole royal family are around a Christmas tree. And after that, suddenly all households want to have a Christmas tree, as you did at the time. And obviously that comes from his childhood, Christmas childhoods in Germany, because Albert is, you know, has his these memories. And Queen Victoria was so taken with In Memoriam and with its expression of how you work through your pain over three consecutive Christmases. It's a very long poem, but it's beautiful. And at the end you have this very celebratory, you know, bit where most people know that ending, I suppose, this ringing of the bells and bringing in the new. Ring out wild bells to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out wild bells and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. And for her, you know, she was saying that next to the Bible in memoriam is my comfort, she was saying after Albert's death. And she asked for an audience with Tennyson as well to talk about this. And actually, her own copy of In Memoriam has scribblings all over with her own notes. And the one I find the most moving is in Canto 29, where Tennyson is saying, "With such compelling cause to grieve as daily vexes household peace and chains regret to his decease, how dare we keep our Christmas Eve?" And Victoria's writing on the side, "We did not keep it in 1861.
Yeah, very interesting. Jan and Gafili's been in touch, enjoying listening to us this morning, Demetra. She says we're reminding her of her childhood Christmas traditions. She says we always had goose and we always cooked it before the coal fire on a spit, and it had a pan underneath to catch all the goose fat, and my dad was in charge of basting the goose. And afterwards my mother kept the goose fat in jars because she says it was very good if anyone had a cold.
But
what did they do with it?
I remember my dad saying to us, to wind us up when we were very, very small, when we wanted something.
What, did you rub it on or eat it?
Well, no, he would wind us up by saying, what you need is some goose grease, which would terrify us, and suddenly we'd become better.
Oh, absolutely. Jan, lovely to hear from you.
This is from Steve in Gloucester, listening to our talk about Christmas traditions. The wren is not the smallest bird in Britain.
I got this wrong.
It is the goldcrest or possibly the firecrest. But lots of people get this wrong because there is always a debate in the twitching world, says Steve. And Steve says, I visit Wales every day and I love listening to the show driving my van. I deliver heat treatment metals for a company to locations all across the country. Steve, lovely to have your company, and we wish you a Merry Christmas as well, by the way. Thank you very much for getting in touch.
Demetra, lovely to see you. Thank you very much indeed for
coming in.
We wish you a happy Christmas.
That's
Demetra Femi. She's lecturer in English at Cardiff Metropolitan University. You're getting in touch with your snow reports, which is